before we get into today's episode, we need to talk about a serious subject. Did you know that Red Cross responds to an emergency every 8 minutes? Nobody else does this. Not the government, not other charities. From small house fires to multi-state natural disasters, the American Red Cross goes wherever they're needed, so people can have clean water, safe shelter, and hot meals when they need them the most. They respond to an average of more than 60,000 disasters every year, and 95% of their disaster relief workers are volunteers. If you would like to help the Red Cross help communities in your area, head to redcross.org or follow the link in my show notes and consider donating today. Every year around the world, millions of people celebrate the miraculous birth of a baby, meek and mild. This baby would be one of the most consequential figures in world history. It's a story that almost everybody has at least heard of. It's maybe the least obscure piece of history. However, in December 1931, there was another miraculous baby to celebrate, and you've never heard their name. My name is Josh, and this is Obscure History. It was a starry night in the desert of Arizona, lightless save for the brilliant flecks of silver breaking through the Earth's atmosphere from distant stars, and a pair of yellow headlights. Mr. and Mrs. Stewart sat in their car, humming along the highway as quickly as possible. Business had kept them out of town longer than expected, and their 8-month-old daughter was home in Mesa, in the care of a neighbor. The Stewarts felt anxiety rising in their chests. They needed to get home. Not only was their young child overstaying their welcome with the neighbors, but it was Christmas Eve, and the couple were eager to start the wonderful business of merging family traditions into new and unique celebrations. It was their first Christmas as parents and their daughter's first Christmas on the planet. It was supposed to be a special night, but business had sucked the joy out of the occasion. Their night went from inconvenient trouble to complete disaster when suddenly... the car slowly rolled to a stop on the side of the road. Immediately, the couple knew they'd blown a tire. Ed Stewart also knew that he had a spare and all of the tools needed to make the repair. Cursing under his breath, he grabbed the tire iron and the spare tire and got to work. As Mr. Stewart fumbled with lug nuts and wrenches, Mrs. Stewart decided to go for a walk. It was a brisk evening. Mrs. Julia Stewart's breath gathered in small puffs in front of her face as she idly paced. The moon was bright enough that she was able to easily avoid any cacti or unfriendly desert creature. Each step filled her with an intoxicating cocktail of enchantment and dread. But something pulled at her, urging her to continue into the darkness. For a moment, the only noise she heard was her feet grinding the desert sand beneath her tender steps and her own breath. But the distant cry of a coyote snapped her out of her fugue. She quickly turned around and began the short walk back to her husband, but before she could make it there, she noticed something out of place. On the opposite side of the road, near their car, there sat a small circular object, not quite the size of a tire. She began to walk towards the object and discovered it was a leather hat box. Maybe it was just the circumstance, or maybe it was the eerie glow cast upon the desert by the moon and stars, but something deep within Mrs. Stewart called her into action. She shouted for her husband to come and check out the mysterious box, and when he ignored her, she shouted for him again. Begrudgingly, Mr. Stewart sat down his tire iron and made his way over to his wife and the mysterious box. Frustrated, Mr. Stewart informed his wife that she had simply found somebody's discarded hat box, nothing more than some inconsiderate litter. He pulled his foot back to kick the box and send it spiraling deeper into the desert, but again, something pulled at Mrs. Stewart's heart, and she stopped him before he could do so. She begged him to open the box. In an attempt to appease his wife, Mr. Stewart bent down and opened the box. Inside was a blanket. The Stewarts looked at each other in confusion and horror. They looked back to the box and slowly removed the blanket, only to reveal a small human form. At first they thought it to be a doll, but as the blanket uncovered its face, the form gasped for breath and began crying for comfort. The Stewarts scooped up the infant, took it to their car, and drove back home to Mesa as fast as their car would carry them. Before they even went to pick up their own daughter, the Stewarts went to the Mesa Police Department. After some debate as to who should take the infant in, it was decided that it would be taken to Ma Hugh Dana. Though she had no children of her own, she did love babies and worked as a delivery nurse. She happily accepted the child and volunteered to care for it until her true family could be found. But they never were. While Ma Dana waited for law enforcement to find the baby girl's family, she gave her a name, Marion, and people from all over Arizona came to bestow upon the baby gifts and prayers. And as time continued to march forward, the newspapers tried to aid law enforcement in their search. The day after baby Marion was discovered, this was printed in the Arizona Republic. The fates collaborated late yesterday afternoon, and as the result, a baby girl abandoned on the desert 10 miles west of Superior had been given a temporary home in a Mesa maternity hospital, while 7 families of the Valley City had offered permanent havens. Tire trouble of a homeward-bound Phoenix motorist, the restlessness of the motorist's wife, and the muffled cries that broke the desert's usual vast stillness combined to save the tiny tot just as the approaching dusk heralded another anniversary of the Christ child's nativity. Without a clue as to the babe's identity, peace officers throughout central Arizona were wondering last night who her parents might be, where they are now, and why the wee tot was left 150 feet from the highway in a cacti-studded waste. Overnight, this mysterious infant became a celebrity. Only a couple days after the newspapers began printing her story, thousands of people flocked to Ma Dana's house, and many of them had filed adoption paperwork while they were there in Mesa. In fact, so many families tried to adopt the baby that Judge Green had to make a difficult and unique ruling. He decided that the baby was to be given to an anonymous couple. They would be two people of good repute, and that the public should stop asking questions. In his ruling, Judge Green said that if the baby were to have any chance at a normal life, it would have to have a new start. It couldn't be known as the Hatbox Baby, or Miracle Marion. It needed a new life, and Judge Green felt as if he had arranged for it. And just like that, the Hatbox Baby was gone. Forever. She simply slipped into obscurity and out of public curiosity. However, the story of the Hatbox Baby is not done. In fact, this story is a tangled web, and we are only grasping at the first thread. But before we get into the complexities of this story, we need to pay the bills. So hang tight for about 90 seconds, and when we get back, we'll dig further into this heartbreaking and mysterious tale. Though the Hatbox Baby had seemingly been secreted away in the night, taken to some new life in some unknown land, the mystery persisted. Law enforcement continued their efforts to uncover the Hatbox Baby's origins, and their first and only real lead were the two people who had brought her into the Mesa Police Department on that brisk Christmas Eve night, Ed and Julia Edwards. The young couple each came from tumultuous upbringings. Ed's mother, Lelia, died when he was just a young boy, and as such, Ed and his siblings were taken in by his maternal grandmother, Mary Weller. Weller had left her abusive first husband, but when he refused to leave well enough alone, her second husband, Elton Weller, shot and killed him. And once again, Ed Stewart's family was rocked by tragedy. Ed completed school until the eighth grade, and then he tried his hand in the world of manual labor. Though he would eventually become an engineer at the time of the Hatbox Baby's discovery, he was a driver for Diamond Ice Company. Similarly, Julia's father fell victim to the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic when she was only 6 years old. She was left in the care of her mother and three step-siblings. The two were married when Julia was only 17. The two struggled as a young married couple, and when Julia became pregnant at the age of 18, they struggled as two young parents. To make money on the side, they would take their 1925 Buick into the deserts of Arizona and try to wrangle wild horses, which they would break and sell. Now, certainly, coming from a broken home, struggling to make ends meet, and taking on odd jobs here and there doesn't make a person inherently unreliable or suspicious. But the actions of the Stewarts in the days following the discovery of the Hatbox Baby were bright, waving red flags. On January 11th, the young couple sat before Judge E. L. Green at a child abandonment hearing, and almost immediately, the Stewarts' story changed. This excerpt of the transcript comes from John DeEla's masterpiece of an article for azcentral.com. With reference to this Hatbox Baby, alias Baby Marion, alias Jane Doe, will you tell the circumstances surrounding this child to the best of your knowledge? Truman asked. You mean how I found it? She replied. Yes. Well, I just happened to run onto it, and I didn't want to open the box, so I called my husband, and he opened it, and we saw what was in it. That was all. We just ran across it. She went on to testify that her husband and her two teenage twin cousins had left Mesa at about 8 a.m. that Christmas Eve and had driven up the Apache Trail to the town of Roosevelt, where she visited a friend named Mrs. Hauser. Afterwards, they drove through Miami, then Globe, and Superior without stopping until the car's fuel line broke, around sunset, 7 miles west of Superior, she said. The place where you stopped due to the breaking of the gas line, could you see the baby from there? No, sir, it was surrounded by trees. I mean, some bushes around it. I was walking towards it and I saw it kind of along the roadside. As the examination continued, she was asked again to describe the scene in further detail and go over their route. She repeated the fact that they did not stop in Miami. Drove straight through, she said. The questioning continued. You didn't see anybody around where you found this baby? No. Did you examine the ground to see if you could see any tracks? No. We just looked around. We thought there was something close. We looked, but we couldn't see anyone. Was the top fastened down on the box? Were the clamps fastened? On both sides, but not in front. It didn't set down well tight. Was there anything in the box in the way of a pillow or anything? No, just had its clothes on and a blue blanket around it. Will the baby fit in that box without doubling up? It was doubled up quite a bit. How was it laying? On its back, with its knees almost under its chin. Green asked a couple more perfunctory questions about Julia's cousins, who were in the car, and then turned questioning back over to the prosecution. Was this baby boy or girl? He asked. A girl, they say. You don't know? No. Any distinctive coloring about the baby or description? Just red hair is all I noticed. After Julia was finished on the stand, Ed was called to testify. While his wife had testified that they had made no stops between the towns of Miami, Globe, and Superior, Ed insisted that they had stopped between Miami and Superior to look at the snow. Though their testimony clearly contradicted each other, the most interesting bit of evidence is that climate records from that time indicate that there would not have been snow visible when Ed claimed they had stopped to look at it. And if there wasn't any snow, what did they stop to look at? Did they stop? Why were their stories so different? Their testimony only got stranger under further investigation. There was no shred of evidence in any official record that a Mrs. Hauser existed at all at the time. No address, no census record, no voter registration, nothing. So if there was no Mrs. Hauser, then what exactly were they doing? Also, both of the Stewarts testified to giving the baby some warm water from a thermos, something that didn't really make sense, especially when Julia was nursing her own 8-month-old daughter. In fact, the police report stated that Julia left her husband with the police because she was uncomfortable from not nursing her daughter all day and needed to go home and feed the baby. So if Julia was nursing her own daughter, why would she not feed this poor, helpless baby that had been left on the side of the road for an unknowable amount of time? To further complicate the case, a year later, Julia gave an interview with journalist Orrin Arnold, and her story completely changed. She told him, "Ed got out to change the tire. The air was cold and still, and to keep from shivering, I got out and walked around. The stars were awfully bright on the desert, and I remember that it all looked like pictures you see on Christmas cards. I walked away on the desert from the highway, while Ed was knocking and banging on the wheel. Suddenly I saw something black on the ground near a greasewood brush. It didn't frighten me. I just saw it looked odd, so I called Ed. He hollered back that he was in a hurry to get home and was about to be done with the tire. But I made him come anyway. We went closer. We saw it was a ragged hat box. It was closed, but a piece of cloth hung out. Ed opened it, and something moved inside. Then I did get scared. I clutched at Ed's shoulder, and we heard a little noise. We carefully pulled back the cloth, and Ed struck a match, and we saw that it was a teeny baby. I've never felt so queer in all my life." Whether the inconsistencies in their stories were simply missed, or if they were intentionally ignored, we might never know. After the diligent work of journalist John DeEla and private investigator Alice Simon provided the Hatbox Baby case with enough press to appear on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, a production crew reached out to the Stewarts. They received a simple, single letter in response. It said, "You know as much about the Hatbox Baby as we do. We found her. We know nothing about her. We question why she would care who her mother is when she took her to the desert and left her in the wild for animals to eat. As far as we're concerned, this matter is closed. Please do not contact us again." However, the matter was not closed. Not even close. Though the Hatbox Baby was gone, she was not lost. It would take 55 years before there would be a break in the case. 55 years before anybody would have any clue as to who the Hatbox Baby really was, or where she went. And even then, it would take a lifetime of work afterward to find any substantive answers. But that will have to wait until next week, and quite possibly the week after that. This story is so massive, I want to make sure that I do it justice. Thank you all for listening. I seriously appreciate all of you. In the show notes, you will find links to some of the articles that I used for my research. John DeEla produced one of the most incredible series on this story and dedicated his life to cracking this case. Please support him and his work by checking it out today. All of the court transcripts that I read from were excerpts from his articles, and honestly, so much appreciation for his hard work. He's an amazing journalist and has been, I believe, on multiple Pulitzer-nominated journalism teams. So seriously, high-quality stuff, highly recommended. With that, I don't really have too much more to say, guys. I appreciate all of your support. This show made it onto Bellow Collective's top 100 of 2021, which is just unreal. I seriously am so humbled by that. We officially, I believe, sort of have passed 400,000 downloads, which is also completely unreal. I'm trying to find a fun and exciting way to celebrate that, but I haven't decided on one yet, so I haven't announced anything. But until then, check out the website, obscurehistorypod.com. You can find a link to the merch store. As always, a portion of each purchase goes to UNICEF, because it should. Anyways, I gotta get going. I gotta get this episode out. I appreciate all of you guys so much. Seriously, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for making 2021 an amazing year to produce this show. I'll talk to you later.